This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our week in review program. We've got a lot of important news for you from around the world. We're going to give you the big picture perspective of the major trends that are unfolding and why they're significant. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK.
Hello.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi.
And Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Our top story today is about the rise of nationalism. Brad McDonald talked about this on the Trumpet Daily program yesterday. He has an article up on thetrumpet.com today. He makes a very compelling argument, tying a lot of current trends that we see in the news together into this this concept that he's talking about here. He really brings in so many things: China's currency manipulation, the fact that it's building islands in the South China Sea, the rise of far-right parties in several European nations, and the response to the immigration crisis there. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. Russia's adventurism in Eastern Europe, even the popular rise of Donald Trump in the United States. What is going on here? Well, nations all over the world are retreating from this globalist utopian idea, and they're saying, hey, we need to look after ourselves. This idea that, well, if everybody becomes interdependent enough, if we create a big, happy global economy, we have more trade, more cooperation through international bodies like the United Nations, if we work together enough, if we depend on each other enough, we're going to have peace. And all this effort that has been put into building this wonderful new world order, what has happened? Today, nations are looking around and saying, well, where has all of this gotten us? Really, all it takes is one nation to stop playing along and start wreaking havoc. You know, President Obama says he wants a world without nuclear weapons. So, hey, we'll lead the way. We'll disarm first. What happens when another nation says, well, suit yourself, but we want nukes? Suddenly the plan doesn't work so well. And we live in a world where nations are saying, you know what, this new world order isn't working. We've got to look after ourselves. And that message is resonating with a lot of people in a lot of countries. They want to protect themselves. And in more and more cases, as Brad brings out in this article, they're putting up walls between them and their neighbors. Here's a quote from his article. Fences are making a major comeback in America, Europe, Asia, and the rest of the globe. Some, like Donald Trump's proposed fence along the U.S.-Mexico border, are literal. Others, like China's currency manipulation, are figurative. But they all serve a common purpose: preserving national interests. These fences evidence a major global trend, the rise of nationalism. They manifest a growing shift away from globalization and towards self-interest. Nations are focusing more on protecting their own economies, their own manufacturing industries, their own people, their own cultures, because of uncertain and unstable global socioeconomic conditions. That makes sense, right? Things get more dangerous. Things become more unstable globally, economically, politically, militarily. The natural impulse is to say, I'm going to look after myself. I'm going to look after my own. And this article and what Mr. McDonald is talking about here reminded me of this article back in July 1999 in the Philadelphia Trumpet. It was an article written by the late trumpet writer Ron Fraser, called Return of the Old World Order. And I got that magazine out, looked at it. We had a big illustration covering almost two pages of basically the whole continent of Europe and Northern Africa with these high walls built all over between all of these countries, and the rise of raising of all of the national flags instead of the big, you know, EU, this multinational kind of entity. It's all the return to these national identities. And So that was 16 years ago. Let me just read a couple of quotes from this article by Mr. Fraser. He says, during the 7 years that followed the fall of the Soviet Empire, it seemed that the world became fascinated with the concept of global interdependence. Make trade, not war, became the catch cry as businesses globalized, and the attention of many an influential leader was caught up in the idea that international borders were rendered useless by the universality of an interdependent world economy. New World Order enthusiasts preached the prospect of the disappearance of the nation state. National aspirations were to be subsumed by the forces of commerce and economics. It turns out, Mr. Fraser says in his classic Fraser language, it now turns out that this woolly idea was nothing but a pipe dream. Another quote from later in the article. It is a nation's place in the world and its people that define it. If a nation has a strategic location, such as a prominent sea gate or bounding natural resources, it will simply need to defend itself from other nations which lack or lust after these attributes. Thus, national security subsumes and supersedes economics. And thus it is that the world has reverted to its historical condition as a dangerous place filled with political intrigue, espionage, and warfare. Here we are 16 years down the road. The trend is a lot more advanced today. Gentlemen, how are you seeing this trend unfolding within the regions you're keeping an eye on?
It's so obvious and it's so everywhere. If you look at just about every, it ties into every major political trend in Europe, for example. So we've got the migration crisis that we'll talk more in detail about later, but that's all about me protecting my benefits and not letting these foreigners come in and take the money that would be going to my pension and have it spent on them instead. Then you've got the euro crisis, and that, again, it's, we don't want these southern European lazy Greeks to take my healthcare money. And times have been very good economically for a long time, and people weren't worried about that so much. But now you've got the downturn in the economy. There's a whole load of these different disagreements coming to the surface. And in Europe, you even see it in the way you're starting to get division within countries. So you've got Scottish nationalism now. So things, the economy is getting worse. And so the Scots want to look to themselves rather than to Britain. And then in Catalonia, in Spain, you have a similar dynamic where you've got the Catalan nationalists saying, well, we're subsidizing the rest of Spain. We want to look after our own people.
Yeah, I do find it interesting just how economics, global economy seems to be a trigger for this. I think that nationalism at its core really is a human phenomenon. It goes back to something fundamental in our human nature. If you look at like George Friedman from Stratford, when he writes about nationalism, he talks a lot about the motivations behind nationalism. And he talks about concepts like the love of one's own, the love of self, the love of place, the place you were born to, the place you grew up. He talks a lot about fear and how that drives nationalism. And I think when economies start slowing down, you start having people turn inward and say, look, maybe the government can't take care of me, or maybe I need to protect what I have. And I think that fear that all people have in their core, the fear of the unknown, as Friedman talks about it, is really starting to play a motivating role in this. Because if you think about fear, the next question is, well, how do I protect myself? How do I protect myself? How do I protect myself economically? And how do I protect myself from somebody else coming taking what I have? I mean, at its most elemental, I think that's what it is. And that just escalates because your neighbors, they look and see what you're doing and they don't understand what you're doing. Your neighbors, the nations next door see, oh, well, they're building their military. Well, why are they doing that? Maybe I need to be building my military too. And it starts getting into these self-fulfilling cycles. So I think we are, as Mr. McDonald brought out, at kind of a turning point in our history, moving from this age of globalization back into this age of nationalism, like what we saw in the lead up in the outbreak of World War II.
Well, really, it's the what has dominated all of human history, that looking after yourself. I mean, really, we've been living in this kind of bubble for the last couple of generations. since World War II, for the most part, we've kind of had this relatively peaceful time, and especially a lot of this globalist thinking exploded after the end of the Cold War. But it's proving to be an illusion. And this, it seems like the fundamental underpinning concept behind it is that everything, that basically human nature can be trusted, and that if we're all going to be able to get along, and it ignores the fundamental reality. Like you're talking about George Friedman, I think the words that you were saying expressing that love for the self, it really reminds me of what Herbert Armstrong talked about with the empirical self and how human nature is fundamentally selfish, and especially when resources become scarce, especially when there is need and want, then there's a strong pull to just look after your own. And so you see that happening on a national scale in a way that could really have explosive results from this. Where does a trend like this lead? As you see it playing out here, Mr. McDonald finishes his article, if this nationalist trend continues, and I would just add, it absolutely will continue, there will be more tensions, more rivalries, more disputes, more conflicts, and ultimately more wars between countries and regions as conditions worsen, especially with the global economy. Expect less cooperation, less collaboration, and more tension and conflict. I think if anyone is really watching this with a mind that is grounded in the realities of human nature, what we are seeing really is an object lesson in the way that human nature operates. You're seeing it among nations. You're seeing it in the United States between races and within communities where people are basically, there's us versus them. If things start getting bad, we're going to have to look after ourselves. You see it more and more in more and more of these arenas. Politically, economically, militarily, you're going to see it unfolding in a dramatic way. Let's turn our attention now to Europe and talk more about specifically what's happening there. We'll talk with Richard here in the UK. Start with just an overview of the headlines that you're seeing in Europe this last week.
Okay, well, Serbia signed four agreements with Kosovo this week, and those four agreements take care of a lot of the disagreements between those two parties. And sorting out those disagreements is a key condition for both of these countries to move forward towards EU membership. So with this agreement signed, that's a big hurdle towards EU membership overcome for both of these countries. So we'll see the EU just to continue get more involved in the Balkans region, a very important region for them to project their power in the into the Middle East, and one that's very important for defending their borders, as we're seeing with the migrant crisis. And then Greece has a new prime minister, their first female prime minister. Vassiliki Thanou was sworn in yesterday, and she'll be the caretaker prime minister for Greece until the elections in just under a month's time.
And the top story in Europe, Richard.
Immigration has absolutely dominated the headlines in Europe this week. And we have quite a few articles on this subject in the Trumpet Weekly because it is, like I said, that has been the main story in a whole load of different ways. So we saw more migrants dying at sea, some dying in transit in a truck within Europe. We're starting to see some conflicting responses within Germany. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, has led Germany to make some very dramatic statements saying all Syrian refugees are welcome. But then this has provoked outrage among a small minority in Germany. And there have been arson attacks and people booing and jeering when Angela Merkel gives a speech. Now, we talked a fair bit about the scale of the problem that Europe is facing with immigration last week. And so this time I'd like to focus on how Europe will respond. And we're already seeing some dramatic steps within Europe. And first, I'd like to start with a news story that doesn't seem quite so directly related, but it really demonstrates that this is a problem and that the outcry against this is going to get a lot worse. And so last Friday, we had the train attack that was foiled in France. And we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly from Stratfor analyzing that attack. And they make some important points to bear in mind when we talk about the immigration crisis and all of these Muslims coming in. They say, first, this attack highlights the vulnerability of rail transit and about how many people you have packed together in a small space. It says the number of potential attackers at any given time is very high, and authorities simply do not have the resources to place them all under constant surveillance. And then they conclude by noting that with this attack, had those men that intervened not been there, the story in the news today may have been far more tragic. So there is still huge potential for far more attacks like this within Europe.
So you bring up the point about the trains, just from the standpoint of how vulnerable Europe is as an open society to terrorist attacks, and how much it's almost inevitable that there's going to be more of that kind of pressure and more backlash and counter response from Europeans against what's happening there.
Right, and so we're starting to see the early stages of that backlash and of that response. So one big way that this is coming is the Czech president. He said this week, he said, today a common European army would come in handy, talking about the need for Europe to defend its borders and to be able to protect itself from these immigrants coming in. And we've talked about a European army and the push for a European army to defend against Russia. And so now we're seeing European leaders become more enthusiastic on the idea of a European army from another front. And then another article that we have in the Trumpet Weekly is called What Europe's Refugee Influx Means for EU Foreign Policy. And it's written by Judy Dempsey, who works for an influential think tank. And she concludes, ultimately, this is about the EU recognizing that its crisis management and soft power tools, both always too slow to react, let alone anticipate, can only go so far without hard power. So we will see Europe being forced to use more hard power to prevent things like Syria exploding and to prevent these big wars that are sending, or to at least prevent them getting so out of hand that they send immigrants streaming into Europe. And Europe cannot handle these immigrants, and she brings this out in that article, without developing this hard power. So we're going to see some big changes in Europe's foreign policy.
Stephen Fleury was bringing out another article, and we've included it in this Trumpet Weekly from EU Observer. EU states favor Christian migrants from the Middle East. All of these European countries that are saying, hey, we'll take immigrants as long as they're Christian. We're just not interested in these Muslim immigrants.
Absolutely. And that's a big thing. And this EU article takes quite a sneering attitude towards taking in only Christian migrants, which I think is wrong. But it does bring out a very good point about how you've got all of these different – I think one of the nations, it was Slovakia, came out and said quite openly, you know, Christians are going to fit in much better. And then it catalogues a whole load of – Eastern European nations and how they're reaching out to Christians within the region. And it's also been interesting, I think, how there's not been as big an outcry against this from the other European nations as I would have expected.
Right. It's against EU human rights law to favor one group of immigrants over another.
And I have not noticed a single European head of state or high up person within the EU that's come out and criticized it. Which I think is interesting when you compare some of the witch hunts that they've had earlier against. I think there was, for example, a Maltese candidate for an EU commission who was against abortion, and he was absolutely hounded down and shouted out, and it was a big brouhaha. So they do have the capacity to blow these things up if they want to, but nobody seems to want to make a big deal of this. Which is very interesting. I think it shows that the more
they know what direction the political winds are blowing. They know what the people are thinking. They don't want to be against the people. I mean, you just look at this article and it's right down the line: Slovakia, Ireland, Latvia, Lithuania, Hungary, Czech Republic, Poland, Belgium. All of these countries, you see pretty high profile individuals coming out and saying, "Yeah, we understand that." That there are probably going to be other types of immigrants that might come along, but they're making these very politically incorrect statements about how, you know, they're probably not going to fit in here.
And I think it's only a matter of time before, say, France, a mainstream but also quite Catholic country, until you get someone like Nicolas Sarkozy or someone on the center-right making similar statements.
Yeah, it's another amazing illustration of what we were talking about at the top of the hour, how the, basically people are saying the time of trying to make everybody work, this kumbaya situation, is over. We need to start bunkering down and looking after our own.
And it's also interesting that it shows how Europe's Catholics feel about what's going on in the Middle East, and that they are prepared to get involved and to bring immigrants in and to sponsor these programs to help resettle Christians over into Eastern Europe. And it shows that there'll be an appetite there to get involved militarily as well to protect Christians within the Middle East.
You know, it's interesting, too, just to wrap this segment up, just how much religion in this particular case, how much it is religion that is defining the camps, and how much it's an illustration of what we can expect to see more and more of, particularly with respect to the Europe-Middle East relationship. Is religion is going to be the defining factor that separates these two, and that kind of brings that conflict to a head. Europeans that are saying, look, the fundamental difference is cultural and really more specifically religious, and we have to these guys do not belong in Europe. So very interesting to watch. We're going to turn our attention now to the Middle East. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review program, as we look over the big headlines from around the world. We're going to talk now to our Middle East man, Brent Noctegal. Brent, can you give us the overview of headlines from the Middle East?
Yeah, just a couple at the top here. An Iranian official reiterated this week that Iran views the annihilation of the state of Israel as its most central foreign policy ideal. That's what they're looking out for and what they want to do. This was motivated by the British Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond. He suggested that Iran's hostility towards Israel may have softened because of the nuclear deal. So Iran wanted to come out on the heels of that and say, no, that's not true. We still look forward to Israel's demise. Another story.
You can always count on them to clear up any confusion there.
That's right. Another story actually affects Israel and specifically Jerusalem, and then even more specifically, a really small portion of Jerusalem, just inside the Old City and a bit towards the south in the City of David and on the Mount of Olives, all surrounding the area of the Old City. It has been engulfed by violence, and Mr. Stephen Fleury talked about this earlier on his Trumpet Daily radio show, but there was 580 incidents through the months of June and July this year that included rock throwing, flame bottle throwing as well, all types of just not necessarily murderous acts, but a lot of tension between the Palestinians and the Jews and the tourists that flock to these locations. Now, this is a real small area. I would say probably, I'm just having an approximate guess here, but maybe something like 400 acres is what was included in this territory. And it's where tourists flock most inside Jerusalem. And what you've had is a lot of this violence. Myself, I was in the City of David. That's where excavations take place, just outside the old city there. And 5 years ago, 6 years ago, there wasn't much tension. I could walk right down the street in the middle of the City of David and not fear anything. I'd go to an Arab shopkeeper and I'd buy my lunch. He might, get an extra couple of shekels out of me than the other guys would, but I was fine with that. I didn't feel bad. I didn't feel unsafe, but it looks like tensions are increasing through this area that a lot of terrorists go to. Tourists go to. A slight difference there.
Tourists and terrorists are very, very different from one another, hopefully.
Yes, they are.
Your top story for the region.
My top story here concerns a trend that we're witnessing, and that is the changing of the guard of Palestinian leadership. Now, this is something that we might find confusing or difficult to understand, but it's something that we must pay close attention to. A bit of the background here. Again, we have two Palestinian factions that rule inside Israel. You have the faction of Fatah that rules over what's known as the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and that's the larger territory, including East Jerusalem. And then you have the other territory of the Gaza Strip that's a lot smaller, still with a huge population of Palestinians, and that's ruled by Hamas. Now, if for the past 10 years, if or 20 years, if there's a negotiation for peace between Israel and the Palestinians, the Palestinian leader that acts on behalf of the Palestinian people is the head of the Fatah group, Mahmoud Abbas, continuing on from Yasser Arafat. Now, what we've seen over the past couple of years is the weakening of power of Mahmoud Abbas over Fatah inside of the West Bank. Now, when peace deals fail between Israel and the Palestinians, everyone's like, well, what happened? Well, you've got one guy leading, Mahmoud Abbas, that only speaks for half of the Palestinian people. He only rules over part of the territory. And over time, his power has slowly been removed, and the power of Hamas is rising. Now, how do we see this? So, well, there is an article inside the Trumpet Weekly, and it's called, "Is Russia Hamas's Bridge to Global Diplomacy?" And it details a couple of meetings, or one meeting that took place on August 4th in Doha, Qatar, and that was between the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the head of Hamas. And that was considered quite a win for Hamas. You've got a terrorist organization who is having a foreign diplomatic relations with Russia's chief man that travels around the world discussing foreign matters. And then he was, at the end of that meeting, the Hamas leader was invited back up to Moscow to continue talks. Now, this continues a trend that's been happening over the past year. We've had Hamas officials go up to Turkey, have meetings with Erdogan, the president of Turkey. Last month, we talked about how Hamas was in Saudi Arabia talking to the king of Saudi Arabia. Why isn't Mahmoud Abbas doing all these, having these meetings on behalf of the Palestinian people? It's because the world powers see that Hamas is gradually gaining control and that Mahmoud Abbas has little legitimacy. Now, why is this important? Well, because Hamas is still a crazy terrorist organization that believes in the destruction of Israel and is not willing to let up on that ideal. And you have Russia, who is a member of the quartet that is meant to be dealing with peace between Israel and the Palestinians, meeting with the head of a terrorist organization and probably discussing their way into peace negotiations. There's a few ways that this looks like it's going to fulfill things that we've been saying would happen over the years. And the main thing is that Gerald Flory has been saying that the Hamas group will actually get control over the West Bank. They will oust, when however it happens, the Fatah leadership, and they are going to control, you know, East Jerusalem all the way up to the north of Israel and down further to the south, the full territory of the West Bank. And it looks like world powers are going to help that process along the way.
Fascinating stuff. We'll definitely have to keep our eyes on that in the time ahead. This article that Brent mentioned here is in this week's Trumpet Weekly. The Trumpet Weekly is a report that we produce each week with the most significant stories from around the world. We really do our best to pack it with information that's going to help you to understand your world. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. If you go online to thetrumpet.com, you can become a subscriber to the Trumpet Weekly. Coming up next, we'll have news from Asia and America. Later on in the program, we'll have our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. Over the break, we were just having a little discussion. Our top story was the rise of nationalism, and then the first story in the European overview seemed to contradict that about this alliance that's happening among certain European states. Who wants to give a little overview of what we were just talking about?
Well, the point was just raised that in Richard's first item, he was talking about Serbia and Kosovo and how they were starting to work together and they had signed some agreements together, which kind of contradicted this idea that we had been talking about, that there'd be rise of know, the individual nation states confronting each other in history. And I think some people just made some good points. And Richard, well, you can go ahead and just say what you had said if you want about that.
Sure, yeah. What longtime readers of The Trumpet will be familiar with, and what I probably should have pointed out, is that, of course, Serbia is getting its arm twisted to do this. They're getting a whole bunch of aid from the European Union. They get a huge amount of money for moving towards EU membership, and a lot of that gets cut off if they do what Europe does not like. So actually, getting together with Serbia is very, very unpopular on its own. Sorry, getting together with Kosovo is very unpopular on its own within Serbia. But the EU is basically bribing its way in there using carrots and sticks, and so that's why they're moving forward with this.
But you also have this trend of the nations within Europe and elsewhere who recognize rising dangers and are really looking to other nations in a sort of a desperate measure for in order to secure their own interests. And you see alliances of necessity developing. And like, just look at the way that Poland is turning its attention to Germany. That's not something that you would have ever expected after World War II. But Poland is more afraid of Russia than it is of aligning with Germany. So in another sense, it's on a smaller scale, and especially within Europe, we're going to expect to see that. We're going to see that within Asian nations coming together as another response to exactly the kind of trends that we're talking about globally.
I think the biggest way that this is going to reveal itself is in the Middle East, because we talk about the alliances that are going to take place in the Middle East, and they are going to be purely governed by self-interest. Why is that? Well, you can see the rise of one alliance headed by Iran is going to trigger and is triggering all these other Sunni Arab states getting together, which what is something you'd expect because that is a nationalist religious spirit. But then they end up aligning with Catholic Europe. Now, why are they doing that? This isn't because they love Christianity. This is because they need Catholic Europe to help them counter Iran. So while it might seem like contrary ideas that you have this time of building alliances and also a time of nationalism, they actually, nationalism would feed into the alliance idea.
The other thing is that these alliances are not going to last. These are alliances that come together for a very short amount of time. There's a certain imperative because of the severity of events happening on the world stage that necessitates these, but ultimately they don't hang together. Once circumstances change, then they fall to pieces.
And that's exactly what we see with Europe and with the prophesied rise of that European superstate. It's very temporary. It's very short term. The Bible talks about the 10 kings, but there still are 10 kings within that superpower.
Yeah, 10 distinct entities. And like the Asian states, it's called the kings of the East. It's multiple political entities over there that kind of come together in one block for a short time. And speaking of which, let's turn our attention now to the overview of headlines from Asia by talking to Jeremiah Jacques.
Sure. Yeah, Japan is not immune to this outbreak of nationalistic fervor that we've been discussing. And on Thursday, Japan launched the second in its new class of helicopter carriers. That's the largest Japanese class of ships since World War II. And the unsettling thing about this new ship is that it is named the Keiga. That's the same name as the World War II Imperial Japanese Navy carrier that was a key part of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. And so analysts say this is beyond coincidence, and some wonder how long the U.S.-Japan security alliance will last as Japan continues becoming more nationalistic. Also, South Korea and North Korea said on Thursday that they have reached a dramatic turning point for relations between the two nations. This comes just on the heels of one of the most tense weeks we've seen on the Korean Peninsula for quite a while. Suddenly, there are even whispers of possible reunification. But the Koreas have made these types of announcements several times over the years before slipping right back into business as usual with hostility, so it's probably still a little too soon to break out the celebratory bottles of soju. And then here in the U.S., we've been hearing all kinds of things about China's Black Monday, the week that the stock market collapsed there, and it was just absolutely hammered. But a story came out this week showing that in China, that story is being heavily censored. When you search on China's largest search engine there, the results come back saying, due to certain concerns, these results are being filtered. So it just shows a potentially authoritarian sort of direction Chinese President Xi Jinping may be taking.
All right. So your top story has nothing to do with Asia. We're going to take a little bit of a left turn here as we go to what you want to bring out now.
Yeah, I wanted to discuss a story about psychology studies that was published this week in the journal Science. I'm sure that we're all used to reading articles and hearing about scientific studies proving various things about human psychology, human cognition, and human behavior. Well, in this new landmark study, more than 270 researchers from around the world came together and they tried to replicate the findings of 100 major studies recently published in top psychology journals. So they conducted the same experiments with the same controls, the same sample sizes, and all they wanted to do was confirm the findings of these previous published studies. And what they found was that only 1/3 of those studies could be replicated. That is a staggering number. It means that over half of these attempts at replication failed. And this is it's a huge black eye for the scientists who originally conducted those studies, to the journals who published them, and to the field of psychology in general. These 100 studies were not small ones either, but they intentionally targeted major studies that were published in top psychology journals. So you would expect the highest degree of scientific integrity and the highest levels of research being done here. And it's also significant that the professor of psychology who led this team that tried to replicate the originals really wanted to prove them valid. They didn't set out, you know, go into this attempting to discredit the originals. It was quite the opposite. In many cases, he even worked with the original researchers, called them up and said, how can I make this work? I'm having trouble duplicating your findings. Here's a quote from him. His name is Professor Brian Nosek. He said, there is no doubt that I would have loved for the effects to be more reproducible. I am disappointed.
And reproducibility is kind of the foundation of scientific integrity, right?
That's right. This is a major development because of the way, you know, society reverences and vaunts scientific studies. They've got to be reproducible. But we really bow to these kinds of findings. And we make major decisions based on them. Psychiatrists and other doctors decide how to treat patients based on psychology studies. Teachers decide how to teach students based on all of these kinds of cognitive studies. So we put a lot of stock in them, but it turns out that the vast majority of the time, the findings are not replicable, and therefore, according to the very rules that science gives itself, they're not valid.
Yeah, if you can't reproduce something, you don't understand what's going on. I mean, that's the fundamental underpinning that lies beneath the scientific method. If you can't reproduce it, you don't know if what you are, your conclusion is any different from what people in the Middle Ages have, you know, prescribed for healing ailments, you know, putting leeches on people and letting blood and all those kind of things. It really is not a lot different. It reminds me of another, we talk about this in the science class at the college, reminds me of another study that was done, I think 2 years ago. Researchers from several colleges came together and kind of the same sort of thing. And they looked at 500 and I think 23 studies that have been published in peer-reviewed journals, and they could only reproduce one out of all of them. And I mean, the thing, and it's just really telling because, as you said, Jeremiah, science is held up as a god. I mean, science is the god of this world at a certain level. And if you can't trust science, I mean, if it takes more faith to trust in science, I mean, what are we left with if you can't trust, you know, the peer-reviewed journals? And it's a big question that science is struggling with.
Was there any indication of what some of the studies were that were discredited by this attempt to replicate them?
One of the studies that they failed to replicate claimed that encouraging people to believe that there was no such thing as free will made them cheat more often. Yeah, it's very specific, but but it was one that was broadly published, and basically it just said, as long as you sort of tell people that it's all fate, you're not actually an entity capable of making decisions, and they will cheat more often. And it was a really strong finding. I mean, 80-90%, something like that. But then these guys came back and re-examined that, and it turns out it's totally false. They could not replicate that.
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's in the medical field, especially statins. Do they prevent heart, you know, drugs, Lipitor, Crestor? Do they work? Don't they work? Do they work? Don't they work? Cell phones, do they cause brain cancer? Yes, Next study, no. Next study, yes. The most recent study that came out a month ago, yes, they do. I mean, this happens all the time. And yet, as you said, people are basing life, you know, potentially life-threatening decisions on these studies.
Now, you're saying what this individual tested was specifically psychological findings. And you're speaking about science more broadly in terms of medicine and that type of thing. Is there a difference between what you can expect? I mean, if they got one third of them right, that's better than one out of 523, I guess.
Yeah, the 523, I believe that was just scientific studies in general. The one this week, these 100 studies that they examined were specifically cognitive and social psychology studies. So how people behave, perception, attention, memory, social issues, self-esteem, identity, prejudice, and how people interact. That's what the ones in this most recent meta study were about.
Yeah, it just shows that as humans, we love to confirm the things that we believe. And I think this is what this is showing. Like, we all have our biases. We all have things that are deeply held truths, quote unquote, in our minds. And we're finding that science is just subject to the same things that everybody else is. You can look at, you know, there's been very famous examples of this in history. Robert Millikan, he was the first to measure the charge of the electron. For 40 years, people conformed their findings on the charge of an electron, something that should be very easy. You know, scientific methods were improving, technology was improving. Scientists should have been able to determine, you know, what is a charge of an electron. And instead, what researchers did is they found reasons to exclude data that didn't conform to Millikan's number, the Nobel Prize winner. And this is like a huge black eye for science, but it happens in more fields than we'd like to admit.
You know, it just makes me think about the scripture that says all scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, 2 Timothy 3:16. There's something absolute about this. There's something that you can depend on. There's something that every time you go back to it, you're going to get the same answer. And there's something very awesome about that, the fact that it comes from God who designed all of this, and it is something that you can put your faith in, by stark contrast to some of these other findings that we're talking about here. Well, thank you for that story, Jeremiah. We'll turn our attention now to Anglo-America. And Robert, first start with the overview.
Sure. Report out by Judicial Watch this last week confirming that Muslim terrorists are actually entering Texas with assistance from Mexican drug cartels. This was based upon an internal Texas Department of Public Safety report. So they're saying that, look, there's known Islamic terrorists that are entering America. Another item this week, there was a grisly murder in Portland, Maine. That was the case of the three Muslim refugees, people who were led into America because supposedly they were persecuting others. Well, they got into a fight and tortured and killed a Christian.
They were being persecuted wherever, right, wherever they came from.
That's correct. And so we let them in here for their own safety, supposedly in here. They brought their violence with them in this case. They targeted a Christian, tortured him for several hours before killing him. Just to put this in context, over the last couple of years, America has brought in about 100,000 refugees just from Somalia alone. 1,000 of them have settled in this area, Portland, Maine, where this murder took place.
But this story is not going to go away anytime soon, is it? So can you tell us your top story from America this week?
Sure. The top story this week was the killing of the Virginia reporter and the cameraman with her live on air. Many people across America, I'm sure, saw this. You heard about that racist, psychopathic black man that shot and killed two people. And he did it while recording it on camera. And then afterwards, when he escaped, he went and put it on the internet and broadcast it around for everybody to see. And it just looked like something right out of a first-person video game. You've probably all seen him. He had the gun in front of the camera, and he's walking her up to the who he's going to kill, and he pulls his trigger and starts shooting. It's the same sort of thing that parents let their kids play all the time with video games, the same sort of images.
So there was the footage that actually aired on the television. It was a live report on a local news station. You're talking about footage
that's
he himself recorded.
That's right. There was the two footage. There's the footage from the cameraman from ABC News, and then there was the shooter himself who wore a camera while he was conducting it, and he broadcast it for everybody to see and went viral.
Horrifying.
It was, but I think what's caught my attention most about this was just the racist nature of this attack, because he sent a 23-page manifesto to the news stations afterwards, and he said that he was motivated by the Charleston shootings, and he said that he's suffered all this racism in his life for being a black man and being gay, and now he wanted to take it out on society. And in reality, while he was calling society racist, he was a racist because, as it turns out, he was fired from his previous employment because he was racist, because he went around accusing pretty much everybody in the whole organization of being racist, and he was let go because of that. And, sadly, we're going to see these kind of attacks continue. We know that's going to happen because Bible prophecy says that it's going to happen, and these sorts of things are going to just intensify as we go forward.
How much has the fact that this manifesto that you're describing was so racist is factoring into mainstream reporting? This was obviously a big story in a lot of places, but his racist motives were not reported.
Yeah, absolutely. There was reporting on it, no doubt. ABC News did talk about how they had this manifesto mailed to them, but it was a completely different narrative mainstream across America than what we saw with, for example, the Charleston shooting or some of these other ones that have happened with the police killing black people in, white police officers shooting black people in Ferguson or elsewhere. Very different narrative.
Thank you very much, Robert, for this. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly, our weekly news report. The stories we're talking about are in this report for this week. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from our panelists coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from the week that caught our attention. We'll start with Brent.
We have this article called On Syria, Germany Stands Out, Stands Up. If you're following anyone in Syria, Lebanon, the Middle East, on your Twitter feed, you probably would have seen Angela Merkel there with the Syrian flag behind her with love hearts and all manner of just happy and joyous rainbows and butterflies, things like that over your Twitter feed, because the Syrians are really happy with her. She said that Germany is going to, as even Richard brought out earlier, defy EU regulations and accept any and all Syrian refugees into her country. Now, this is interesting because at the conclusion of this article, I'll just quote it for you, it highlights where this might be leading. It says, for Germany's chancellor, this will boost Berlin's credibility in the Middle East as an impartial problem solver, helping alleviate the suffering as many who directly contribute to it chose to ignore it. And this falls in line with something that we've been saying for a while, how Germany is going to get involved into the Syrian crisis. And this is what we wrote earlier this year on thetrumpet.com. We said, above all, watch to see if Germany doesn't make a strong move to pick up the pieces and to actually use Syria as a tool to fight Iran, to actually get in there and get involved in the Middle East.
Thank you, Brent. Now on to Richard.
We have an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly that focuses on the Pope's soon coming trip to America. And what I think is really fascinating about this article is it brings out how closely the Pope's goals align with America's current leadership. So it basically talks about how the Pope has taken up the mantle from Mr. Obama as being the kind of beacon of the world's hopes. It says Obama has made no secret of his affection for the outspoken Pope, calling him a transformative leader. It says the Pope has embraced many of the issues Mr. Obama has sought to advance. And then also Joe Biden, the vice president, said that the visit will mark an important moment not only for Catholics but for all America. So there's some very interesting tidbits ahead of the Pope's visit, and keep watching for that to have a big impact on America and on the world.
All right. Thank you, Richard. On to Jeremiah.
Well, we've talked before about China's massive land reclamation projects there in the South China Sea, just dredging up dirt to make artificial islands. And we've said that China now has some 2,900 acres of land that used to be underwater. We've got a new article this week, though, that just focuses on the fleet of ships that China's been using to make all of that land. And China has now amassed the largest fleet on Earth of dredging ships. So they went from being fifth in dredging capabilities about 10 years ago to now number one on the planet. They've got an unrivaled ability to dredge. And this article by War is Boring just makes a really compelling case that this dredging fleet could be used to militarily secure a lot of these new territories and even to extend China's maritime Silk Road that it's building from its mainland all the way to Djibouti.
Very impressive. And finally, on to Robert.
Well, China appears to be dumping its U.S. Treasury stockpile. In the past 2 weeks alone, China has sold a gargantuan $106 billion in U.S. paper. In the past 2 weeks, it has sold more than it has sold in the entire first half of the year. So we're seeing a big change. Something's going on in China. The question is, why are they selling? Why are they dumping now? Some analysts think that it's related to the economic trouble, the stock market in China collapsing. Some analysts have suggested that the China's plunge protection team has entered the market and is now actively buying stocks to prop things up. In any case, I think it's just a sign of the instability over there and of instability in global markets in general.
Thank you very much, Robert. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Send us your thoughts or questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. We're also on Facebook and Google Plus. If you search for us for Philadelphia Trumpet, you can find us. Thanks to our panel, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, Robert Morley. It's been a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank
you. You're welcome.
Thanks.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I will leave you with the words of Mark Twain. When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much he had learned in 7 years. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.